Is there something interfering with your happiness, or are you struggling mentally? If so, don't suffer in silence. BetterHelp Online Counseling is there to help you. They are an online professional counseling service with 3,000 licensed therapists available to anybody, no matter where you're from. Sometimes admitting that you need help can be daunting, but with BetterHelp, you can get help at your own time and at your own pace. They have professionals specializing in a variety of fields, from depression and anxiety to family conflicts and sleeping issues. Rest assured that whatever you share is completely confidential and you can contact them via text, chat, phone, and video. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/morbidology. Join over 8,000 people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/morbidology. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. In 2005, Ideal Home magazine carried out a survey which showed that 1 in 5 women keeps a weapon beside her bed to defend herself against intruders. A number of women also carry concealed weapons or alarms while out in public, out of fear that they will be attacked. While it may seem to be an extreme reaction to the nation's obsession with crime, it is a behaviour that for a number of women is completely normal. In Croydon, London, in September of 2005, a young model was attacked on the driveway of her own home, giving legitimacy to the fear that millions of women face. Sally Ann Bowman was an 18-year-old model from Croydon, London. She had been a student at Cheam High School until 2002, when she left with qualifications in theatre, drama, maths and English, and went on to attend the Brit School for the Performing Arts in London, which was notable for its celebrity alumni, including Amy Winehouse, Jessie J and Adele. "She was a tremendous student, who we remember very fondly indeed," said the principal, Nick Williams. Slim and standing at 6 feet tall, Sally Ann was destined for the catwalk, and it was during her time at school that she realised that modelling was her ambition. Her biggest dream was to one day be on the cover of Vogue, and was determined that her future lay far from the humdrum existence of South London. In January of 2005, Sally Ann signed a contract with Pulse Model Management. She celebrated great success with Pulse, and quickly became one of their leading models. She had the striking looks, but also it was the way she moved along the catwalk. She was a natural, recollected Peter Kaminsky, managing director of Pulse.
"We didn't teach Sally to do anything. She already had that quality of that models have, that models need to have in front of a camera or on a catwalk."
Sally Ann had done 4 catwalk shows for designers in central London, including one in the upmarket Café de Paris in Piccadilly. Sally Ann was so good, in fact, that she was the face of Pulse and featured on their business cards and newspaper ads. She made such an impact on the modelling world that in March of 2005, Sally Ann appeared in the prestigious Swatch Alternative Fashion Week in London. After appearing in the Fashion Week, she said, "I'd love to be compared to Kate Moss because she is just so amazing. To be where she is one day would be brilliant." The future for Sally Ann was certainly looking bright, and then on the 11th of September 2005, she finally turned 18, which meant that she could sign full exclusive contracts. Towards the end of September, Sally Ann was scheduled to sign a permanent contract with Pulse, which could have seen her raking in millions of pounds. Peter had hoped that when Sally Ann signed that contract, he would be able to get her to star in London Fashion Week. Sally Ann was extremely close to her mother, Linda Bowman, as well as her sisters, Nicole, Michelle and Danielle. Linda and Sally Ann's father, Paul, had split up when Sally Ann was 11 years old. Sally was noticed wherever she went. Heads would turn, she knew it and she enjoyed every minute. She was always glamorous, even when just going shopping in Asda, recollected Linda. Her sisters often joked that Sally Ann was a real drama queen and always managed to take the limelight. Sally Ann had a real soft side when it came to children, and she doted on her four nephews and nieces. According to her sister, Nicole, Sally Ann treated the kids like they were her own children and spoiled them rotten. She could hardly wait to be a mother herself.
Sally's modelling was her part-time job, something that she loved to do, always wanted to do from when she was little. Got the opportunity and took it with both hands, but that was just part of Sally. I don't know, they just portray her as the model Sally, wasn't her? Sally was Sally.
Happy-go-lucky, always laughing, giggling, singing. She wanted the fairy tale. She wanted to work hard, you know, be able to support herself financially. She then wanted the home, then the marriage, then the children. She just had this little thing that she just wanted to be known. She wasn't going to be this big celebrity or anything else, just wanted to be known.
Sally Ann wasn't just a pretty face, though. She was extremely intelligent and was an amazing singer and dancer. Her favourite songs to sing on karaoke were My Heart Will Go On by Celine Dion or All My Love for You by Whitney Houston. Her best friend, Sophie McSorley, said that Sally Ann was the best friend anybody could have ever asked for. She was kind, thoughtful, fun to be with, and always there for me, said Sophie. To make ends meet while attempting to make her dreams come true, Sally Ann worked at Blast Hair Salon, a local hairdresser. With the money she was earning, Sally Ann was able to move out on her own and rented a room in a house on the tree-lined nondescript middle-class street of Blenheim Crescent in Croydon. While some neighbourhoods in the area could be a bit dodgy, Blenheim Crescent was a desirable area. To celebrate her 18th birthday, Sally Ann and her on-and-off-again boyfriend, Lewis Broston, had booked a holiday to Kos in Greece for a week of relaxation and sun. Sally Ann and Lewis had met back when Sally Ann was 16 years old. She had been in the pub that Lewis's father had owned in Tooting. She was chatting to her mum and she suddenly turned round and I saw the biggest smile and the brightest blue eyes anyone could imagine. I knew I had to meet her, he recollected. Sally Ann had been bursting with excitement about their upcoming trip to Kos. It was the first time she had ever been on vacation on her own. She had booked it 6 weeks earlier and had been counting down the days with little coloured dots on the wall calendar in the staff room of the hairdressers. The relationship of Sally Ann and Lewis had been marred by blazing rows and jealousies. While they had their arguments, they always made up. By the time they went to Kos, they had called it quits on their relationship once again, but went as friends.
He was your typical teenage boy. You know, he went out to work, he worked. You know, he had a lot of respect for Sally Ann. They were the perfect couple. They were like the Posh and Becks of, you know, Surrey. They had their moments. They were teenagers. They used to argue and bicker. But then who doesn't?
On the 24th of September 2005, Sally Ann had agreed to a night out with a number of her girlfriends and her sister in Croydon Town Centre.
Sally Ann had woken up and just laid about all day in her pink fluffy dressing gown, watching telly, munching on biscuits and crisps and God knows what. And then the phone went a couple of times. It was sister Nicole asking if she'd like to go out for the evening, as it was Nicole's best friend's birthday. It was about 6:05 in the evening on the Saturday the 24th, and I went to the door, and Sally just said, "Love you, Mum." I said, "Love you too." It was the last time I saw her.
Sally Ann pulled on a blue denim skirt, a white bodice top decorated with butterflies, and a pair of white high heels. Between 10 p.m. and 1 a.m, the group of girls were in Lloyd's bar, and afterwards they headed back to another friend's house. That night, Lewis had been out with his friends in Kingston, and while he and Sally Ann weren't technically together, she was anxious about what he was doing. She didn't really trust Lewis with other girls. So Sally Ann concocted a story to get Lewis to come and pick her up, and claimed that Nicole had been arrested for fighting. Lewis, at first, was apprehensive. He didn't think it was fair that he had to leave his friends, but he didn't want Sally Ann to be stranded alone. From her friend's home, Sally Ann caught a taxi back to Catherine Street, Croydon, and then met Lewis outside Lloyd's at 2 a.m, and he gave her a lift back home. At 2:13 a.m, Sally Ann is captured on CCTV standing outside waiting for Lewis to pick her up. She climbed into his car and he dropped her off around 50 yards from her house. However, Sally Ann didn't immediately get out of the car. She and Lewis sat in the car for around 2 hours and spoke about their relationship. The conversation became quite heated, with each accusing the other of seeing other people. In the early morning hours, two neighbours of Sally Ann heard a deafening scream, echoing throughout the quiet street. Ray and June Cumper said that it was around 4 a.m. when they heard the scream. They glanced out of their bedroom window and saw someone walking past a skip just outside the house, but didn't think to investigate. Then at around 6:30 a.m, another neighbour came across what she believed was a mannequin lying on the pavement beside the skip. As she got closer, however, she realised that it wasn't a mannequin at all, but instead, the naked body of a young woman surrounded in a puddle of her own blood. She was cold to the touch, and it was evident that she was dead. The young woman was quickly identified as Sally Ann. Her autopsy would conclude that she had been raped and stabbed repeatedly with a carving knife on the drive of her own home. It had been a particularly vicious attack, with one stab wound that went right through her body. Additionally, the killer had bitten Sally Ann on her neck, cheek, and breast during the frenzied attack.
We know that Sally was stabbed at least 7 times. Of those 7, 3 of them were so strong, the stab wound, that they passed through her body. 2 went through her abdomen and out the back. She had been bitten a number of times. There was a number of areas on her body, including the bite marks, that yielded DNA. We were also able to ascertain that Sally Ann had also been raped. And the evidence suggested that that had occurred after she had been killed.
Sally Ann had fought for her life and had sustained defensive stab wounds to her arms. The killer had then placed concrete rubble from the skip on Sally Ann's body and stuffed it into her mouth. Police now had the daunting task of informing Sally Ann's family of her murder. Next, we will hear from Sally Ann's sister, Michelle.
I just remember this look in their eyes where you just know there's something that's not quite right. And they said, oh, do you know Sally Ann Bowman? And me, I went, what's she done? No care in the world. Like, Ella was sitting on my lap. She was only little. And I said, I'm really sorry to tell you, but Sally was found murdered this morning. And I remember something leaving me that day. And it's never, ever come back. I remember sitting there screaming and Ella sitting on my lap saying Mummy was wrong. And I just said, don't worry. Mummy's got something in her eye. And she said, I'll kiss it better, Mummy. I'll make it all better for you. But there's not anything in this world that will ever make it better.
Michelle and Linda were taken to the mortuary for a positive identification of Sally Ann.
I went with Mum to go and identify Sally. I'll never forget. I just remember standing in the car park out the back and you can hear them wheeling her through. And that thing just taking over, just wishing that it's not her. I remember going into the room and for that split second, I thought it wasn't her because her hair was dark. And then I moved forward and you just see a little button nose and a little freckles. And that was it. Part of me didn't want to look. I could feel Michelle behind me, and as I looked round, I just fell to pieces. My Sally laying there.
in a black zip-up body bag up to her neck. Hair all tied back of her head where hair had sort of, they'd washed the blood from her hair. I see a tiny wound to her neck. And Michelle was just screaming and crying, asking me to wake her up. Please wake her up, Mum. And it's, sorry, it was just horrendous. But all I could do was touch the glass. I wasn't allowed to go anywhere near my daughter. And all I wanted to do was hold her and kiss her, but we weren't allowed.
Following the discovery, an investigation into Sally Ann's murder was launched. There is nothing in her background to point towards an explanation for this terrible crime, said Detective Chief Inspector Superintendent Stuart Cundy. Investigators announced that they believed that Sally Ann had been murdered after her killer had attempted to rape her. Sally Ann's jewellery and clothing was discovered yards from the murder scene behind Sally Ann's home. However, her Prada handbag, white crochet bolero-style cardigan, black Samsung D500 mobile phone and passport were missing. Investigators urged locals to keep an eye out for Sally Ann's items and suggested that the person who killed Sally Ann might have discarded them after fleeing the scene. Maybe they have been sold on to you. Maybe you found them and kept them. If this is the case, I urge you to contact me, said a police spokesman. Investigators appealed to anybody who may have been in contact with Sally Ann before her death and asked them to contact them. They also informed citizens that they were still searching for the murder weapon. A number of Sally Ann's friends, who had spent the night before her murder with her downtown, came forward and helped investigators piece together Sally Ann's last known movements before she was killed. As is typical protocol when it comes to murder cases, Sally Ann's boyfriend was the first suspect. Since he and Sally Ann had recently split up, many wondered if this was a revenge attack. In fact, almost as soon as the murder hit headlines, one of Sally's friends said, "They had been going out for about a year, but split up a few weeks ago. She didn't like him that much." By this point, three men, aged 20, 25 and 26, had been apprehended for the murder. But the following day, the two older men were released on bail. It would soon be revealed that the 20-year-old who was being questioned in regards to Sally Ann's murder was Lewis. Investigators were granted an extension of 36 hours to continue interviewing him. Meanwhile, a makeshift memorial appeared at the spot where Sally Ann's body was found, to mark not only the life lost, but to mark the disappearance of any notion of suburban security. A number of family members, friends and locals left flowers and trinkets. One handwritten message read, "For our beautiful granddaughter Sally Ann. She will always be in our hearts. Love Nanny and Granddad." A photograph of Sally Ann was left at the memorial by her mother Linda, with a note which read, "To my darling baby girl, I love you with all my heart, and I will never, ever stop loving you." Towards the end of September, it was announced that a fourth man was arrested in connection with Sally Ann's murder. Just the following day, however, the fourth man and Lewis were released without charge. The men who had been arrested alongside Lewis were his friends, but investigators were now able to rule all of the men out as suspects. Not only did the men have alibis, but they were able to be ruled out with DNA evidence. Now, investigators announced that they believed that Sally Ann had been murdered by a stranger. Following Lewis's release from police custody, he went to the scene where Sally Ann had been murdered and spent around 4 hours there. "I'm very upset right now about what happened. I really can't talk about it. I just want to be left alone. I'm too upset," he told a reporter who tried to interview him. While he and Sally Ann weren't together, they still remained on good terms and were friends. "It's one thing for somebody you love to be taken in such a cruel manner, but it's another to become a suspect in that murder." As Lewis would later say, Sally Ann was the girl of his dreams and the love of his life. Just the following day, Sally Ann's murder would be linked to another sex attack that happened in nearby Purley in 2001. The two crimes were linked by DNA evidence.
A lady who was in a phone box making a phone call when the suspect walks over to her, tries to get into the phone box, and masturbates over the phone box. He manages to get the door open and then ejaculates over the floor of the phone box and then casually walks off across the car park of Tesco's away from her. That remained an unsolved police investigation despite the fact that DNA was obtained from that crime scene. And I say it's the dawning realisation that if the attacker has done that 4 years before and then 4 years later murdered Sally in a truly horrific way, what has he done in that intervening period? And if he has brutally murdered Sally now, what might he do tonight? What might he do tomorrow?
In the 2001 attack, the victim survived and she described her attacker as a white man in his 20s or 30s, standing between 5 feet 9 inches tall and 6 feet. He was of medium build and had short dark hair and was clean shaven. According to Ray and June Cumber, Sally Ann's neighbours who had witnessed a man walking past the skip outside their home shortly after hearing the scream on the night that Sally Ann was murdered, said that this description matched the appearance of that man. Investigators believed that Sally Ann's killer had been hiding in the skip, waiting for Sally Ann to return home. We think it is very likely the killer previously spotted Sally Ann and followed her, perhaps for days or even weeks, said a police source. Following this lead, investigators announced that this man very well could have committed other sex attacks and urged any women who may have been sexually assaulted to come forward and contact them. There was a gap of 4 years, and it seemed unlikely to investigators that the sexual predator would not have committed other attacks in that time frame unless he was abroad or in prison. DCI Cundy said, "We urge anybody who has been a victim of a sexual attack to contact police so we can gather as much information about this man." Additionally, they urged women in the South Croydon and Purley area to remain vigilant. Shortly thereafter, a tip came in from a 36-year-old woman who was violently robbed around an hour before Sally Ann was murdered. The robbery had taken place just 500 yards away from where Sally Ann was attacked. The unidentified woman had been driving along Sanderstead Road at around 3 a.m. when she pulled over to the side of the road because her car had broken down. She was about to call a friend for help when she was confronted by a man who apologised to her before launching a vicious attack with a metal object, causing injuries to her head, back and hands. The woman believed that the man had a knife on his belt. Thankfully, the woman survived the attack and the man ran off with her bag. Just as he took off, a passerby chased him but was unsuccessful in catching up with him. When the woman described her assailant, the description matched the appearance of Sally Ann's killer. In early October, investigators announced that they had received half a dozen calls from women reporting previously unreported crimes, ranging from peeping Tom offences to indecent assault. Some of Sally Ann's neighbours also called in reports of possible prowlers in the area. Shortly thereafter, investigators announced that they had linked Sally Ann's murder to at least 5 more attacks. They additionally announced that they would be searching computer files of sex attacks and robberies in the area and looking for similarities. Investigators now believed that Sally Ann's killer had been carrying out sexual assaults and robberies on a number of women for at least 4 years. As the investigation was underway, Cheam High School held a minute's silence in memory of Sally Ann. A number of Sally Ann's friends were still pupils in the school, and she was well remembered by the other pupils and members of staff. Sally Ann was a popular and well-liked student. "Our heart goes out to her friends and family," said Rebecca Allett, the head teacher. The following day, an eFit image of the suspect in Sally Ann's murder and the attack an hour before was released. It was compiled from the description given by the woman who was attacked and robbed on the same night that Sally Ann was murdered. She described the suspect as being of stocky build with spiky short hair, aged in his 20s or 30s, and standing between 5 feet 9 inches tall and 6 feet tall. He was wearing dark jeans and a long sleeve top. Investigators also announced that they believed that the killer either lived or worked nearby. "I am convinced that this man has connections locally. This is clearly a very dangerous individual, and I appeal to anyone who knows him to contact us urgently. He may have a girlfriend or live with relatives. Someone must know him, and we urgently need any information that could lead to his identification, said DCI Cundy. Investigators also announced that if the suspect was not caught quickly, then they were considering the possibility of a mass DNA test of local men. Following the release of the AFIT, investigators announced a £20,000 reward for any information that could lead to the identification, arrest and prosecution of Sally Ann's killer. The case featured on Crime Watch, and the segment showed the AFIT. Afterwards, a number of tips came in from women who were adamant that they had been followed by the same man or attacked by the same man. One woman said she believed she was attacked by the same man in 2000. Several people even called the Crime Watch hotline to name the killer, and DCI Cundy publicly announced that they would be comparing the DNA at the crime scene to the DNA of the men who had been named. The Sun newspaper subsequently doubled the reward fund, adding another $20,000. By this point, Linda and Sally Ann's sisters had made several tearful pleas for information about her killer. On the 11th of October, her father, Paul, spoke to the media for the first time. As tears filled his eyes, he said, "Sally Ann was a bright, bubbly, and beautiful girl with a refreshing air of innocence. She was 18 years old. Now, there will be no 21st birthday, no wedding, no first house, and no first child. There will just be this emptiness and a deep pain which may well fade, but will never go away." Linda admitted to the media that she wasn't coping with her daughter's death at all, and even feared that Sally Ann's killer would target one of her other daughters next.
"It was a not knowing who he was. It was a not knowing, you know, is he linked to the family in any way? Is it someone that we all know? Is it somebody we trusted? It was the fear of being in your homes at night, locking your windows, bolting your door, jumping every time there's a shadow or there's a noise. And from my point of view as a mum, is he going to get to another one of my girls?" We had absolutely nothing other than DNA. That was all the police had, was DNA.
She installed alarms on every door and window of the home and purchased a panic button, which she wore around her neck 24 hours a day. She demanded identification from all visitors and called her other daughters every single hour to check that they were okay. In an interview with the Sunday Express, Linda said, "The other night I thought I heard Sally Ann screaming outside the front door and I ran outside, and it was just children playing." Linda said that Lewis was struggling too, and she said she wasn't sure if he would ever get over Sally Ann's murder. Lewis and Sally Ann had been so close that Lewis truly became part of the family. By this point in the investigation, Sally Ann's murder was national news. Investigators had a list of 300 possible suspects, most of which had been called in after the release of the AFIT. DCI Cundy said that despite the exhaustive list, no names that had been given were jumping out. Podcorn are revolutionising podcast sponsorships and connecting unique voices to unique brands. There was a time when only the big, popular podcasts received sponsorships, but with Podcorn, indie podcasts like Morbidology are able to work with amazing brands on their podcast. Podcorn have even sponsored this episode. Podcorn takes the stress and confusion out of finding sponsorships for your podcast or finding a podcast to sponsor your brand. It is a simple and straightforward way for brands and podcasters to connect, no matter how small your podcast or how small your brand. Podcorn is truly simplifying every aspect of podcast sponsorships. All you need to do is sign up for free and begin browsing Podcorn's marketplace. The marketplace is easy to use and even has a handy calendar to take the stress out of booking multiple sponsors. One of the best things about Podcorn is that you have complete control over your spend as a brand or your price as a podcaster. Podcorn is a revolutionary way to connect podcasters to sponsorship opportunities, including host-read ads, interview segments, topical discussions, and more. So click the link in my show notes to sign up to Podcorn today. Towards the end of October, it was announced that around 250 men had been eliminated from the list of suspect names that had been put forward by the public. Then in early November, investigators began taking DNA swabs from men in the area.
We recovered DNA from Sally's body. Everything suggested that this murderer was local. In my mind, he was either going to live locally or he was staying locally that night of the murder. So in consultation with Croydon community and others, I made a decision very early on in the investigation that we would conduct an intelligence-led DNA screen. We had nearly 6,000 addresses that we wanted to ascertain every single male that lived in those premises or was there on the night of Sally's murder who might fit the description of her attacker. We anticipated that that was probably about 4,000 men of that description in the South Croydon area. So we took the innovative decision to basically set up a local DNA centre, which hadn't been done before, where we made the request of all the men in this locality to come to us to voluntarily give their DNA.
On the 4th of November, Sally Ann was laid to rest. Her parents led mourners in a horse-drawn procession through the South London suburb where she had lived, before her funeral was held at Croydon Crematorium. More than 400 mourners packed into the crematorium wearing pink and white, Sally Ann's favourite colours. The service included readings by members of her family and friends. A recording of Sally Ann singing My Heart Will Go On was also played during the service. Vicar Stephen Coe told the mourners, "Someone brutally murdered a young person who could not have been more full of life. 1 minute's violence and evil intent has shattered so many lives and extinguished the beauty and vitality of one so young. We pray that justice will come, but our focus today is on Sally Ann." The service was broadcast on loudspeakers outside the crematorium. The family asked that in lieu of flowers, for people to donate to the NSPCC and Cancer Research UK, charities which were supported by Sally Ann. Following the service, 18 white doves were released, one for each year of Sally Ann's life. The following month, Crime Watch showed a recreation of Sally Ann's murder. On the show, DCI Cundy told Crime Watch that investigators believed that Sally Ann's killer may have used her mobile phone to take photographs of her body. He also said that Sally Ann had been raped after her death and that investigators believed that he may have been seen returning to the crime scene. After Crime Watch aired, police received more than 150 calls from the public with potential information about Sally Ann's murder. While Lewis had been ruled out as a suspect in Sally Ann's murder with DNA, that didn't stop the rumour mill from running. On Christmas Day, Lewis and Linda left flowers at the crime scene and attempted to dispel the cruel whispers. "I've been proven innocent 100%. Would I be hanging out with her family if I had anything to do with it?" questioned Lewis. Linda also fought back, stating, "The wicked lies have to stop. These people are murdering Lewis as well. He is like a son to me and I absolutely adore him." The new year brought no new information, as it was revealed that 800 people had been eliminated from the inquiry. In February, Linda wrote to Prime Minister Tony Blair in a bid to get Britain's restrictive DNA rules overhauled. She asked the Prime Minister to make amendments to the Human Tissue Act so that DNA samples could be taken from newborn babies and suicide victims. If they had the killer's DNA from birth, then they would have caught him by now. But at the moment, it's like searching for a needle in a haystack, said Linda. Linda also said that she wanted the government to be able to collect samples from people who die in mysterious or suspicious circumstances. Civil rights group Liberty voiced concerns about collecting DNA samples from people who have not committed a crime. Recent laws have extended the police powers to collect DNA samples from most individuals they come in contact with, even children. Rather than creating a DNA database through the back door, the government should engage in a public debate about the uses and implications of a national database, read their statement. The case by this point had pretty much come to a standstill. While investigators were still receiving tips, none of them proved to be lucrative. Then towards the end of February, investigators announced that they had asked around 4,000 men in the area to give DNA samples and fingerprints. They assured the men that the samples would only be compared to the DNA associated with Sally Ann's murder and would be destroyed once the inquiry was complete. Only one person need fear coming forward to give a sample, and that is her killer, said DCI Cundy. It would be the largest mass DNA testing in UK history. As the DNA testing was underway, investigators released another EFIT of the suspect. This EFIT was compiled by the victim of the sex attack back in 2001, which had been linked to Sally Ann's murder with DNA. The EFIT was pretty similar, but showed a man with a rounder face. However, investigators said that they speculated that it was the same man from the earlier EFIT, but had lost weight over the past 4 years. When the new EFIT was released, a number of Sally Ann's colleagues recognised the man immediately as an Australian man who had been stalking Sally Ann before her murder. According to the colleagues, a man had come into the salon and pestered Sally Ann so frequently for a date that they had asked him to leave. Sally Ann said he had blonde hair. The only reason the police ruled him out in the first place was that the woman in 2001 said he had dark hair, said Linda. However, just the following day, investigators dismissed the claims that the key suspect was the Australian stalker. They released a statement which read, "We've known about the Australian man who was pestering, not stalking, Sally Ann from the second day of the inquiry. The man still remains unidentified, but we are not treating him as a key suspect." The case stalled for several more months, until the end of June, when it was announced that a 35-year-old man was arrested in Surrey, South East England, in connection with Sally Ann's murder. The following day, the man was identified as Mark Dixie. He had been arrested in front of shock customers while working as the head chef at Ye Olde Six Bells in Surrey. Investigators revealed that Mark had been linked to the murder when he was arrested 2 weeks earlier after getting into a fight at a pub following England's World Cup win over Trinidad and Tobago. During the arrest, a DNA sample was taken, and when it was run through the database, it came up as a match to the DNA in Sally Ann's murder.
The officer that dealt with the investigation of the assault in Sussex was surprised how Mark Dixie behaved when they were in police custody, particularly when he was being interviewed. They described him as being quite tearful, which they were surprised about because it was a relatively minor case where he'd pushed somebody over. But they didn't quite know why, couldn't quite put their finger on it. And once he'd, you know, been interviewed, provided his DNA and his fingerprints, he was bailed from police custody. With hindsight looking back, he was probably tearful because this was the point in his life where literally everything came on top for him. And he knew full well that now his DNA had been taken, he would be linked directly to the murder of Sally Ann.
The following day, Mark appeared in court, where he was charged with Sally Ann's murder, as well as indecently assaulting a woman in Purley and outraging public decency on the 15th of June 2001. Mark didn't say a word. He simply nodded when asked if he understood the charges. As he was driven away from Sutton Magistrates Court to jail, the van was pelted with eggs. The arrest, of course, was a welcome relief for Sally Ann's loved ones. "I've been unable to grieve until now, but it started in the courtroom and I broke down. It was painful. I realised she is never coming back. When I left court, I went to Sally Ann's grave and told her what had happened. I feel we have reached the end of one chapter and another is about to begin," said Linda. An investigation into Mark's history and background revealed that he had lived just yards from Sally Ann's home 2 years ago. He worked in several pubs in the Croydon area since 2001, since he returned to the UK after working in Australia for 8 years. During his time in Australia, Mark had lived in Perth and worked in a number of local pubs as a chef. Then in 2001, he was arrested after sexually exposing himself to a woman and it was discovered that his visa had expired several years earlier. At the time of Mark's arrest, Mark had a girlfriend, 20-year-old Katie McGonaghy. Katie was a junior chef at the pub and had begun dating Mark just 2 weeks after they started working together in the kitchen. When it dawned on me that he had been held for killing that beautiful girl, I just felt physically sick, she said. Following the arrest, investigators erected a large tent over the beer garden of the old Six Bells and began an inch-by-inch search in a bid to uncover the murder weapon or the items that the killer had stolen from Sally Ann. They also searched the pub cellar, kitchen and outbuildings. Additionally, they searched Katie's apartment as well as the house where Mark had been living with his cousin on the edge of an estate in Colston, Surrey. Mark had moved in with his cousin after breaking up with his long-term girlfriend and the mother of his 2-year-old son, Stacey Knivett, in the summer before Sally Ann's murder. On what would have been Sally Ann's 19th birthday, her family gathered around her grave and held a day-long picnic. Linda said that the day was tearful and difficult, but it was a fitting tribute to Sally Ann. Just 2 weeks later, the one-year anniversary to Sally Ann's murder rolled around. A minute's silence was held at the spot where she was murdered, while Linda unveiled a plaque which read, "In loving memory of a much-loved daughter, sister and friend, my heart will go on." The plaque was installed while council officials decided whether a permanent memorial could be installed on the street. Linda had requested a permanent plaque, but residents in the neighbourhood opposed after worrying that the plaque would cause problems if they ever attempted to sell their homes. Just days after the temporary plaque was installed on the tree beside where Sally Ann was murdered, it was defaced. It was soon revealed that while the murder case was moving through the British justice system, Australian police were investigating possible links between Mark and cases over there. Mark had lived and worked in Australia for a number of years, but had returned to the UK after his visa expired. One of the cases Australian police were looking into was the Claremont serial killings. Claremont is a leafy suburb in Perth, Australia, and over a 14-month period beginning in 1996, three women were abducted and murdered after leaving nightclubs.
The Claremont serial killings have haunted Perth for over 20 years.
Every parent's nightmare.
Really quite terrifying.
Vanished from the same area.
Australia's longest running police investigation.
We certainly have fears that there is a serial killer at loose in Perth.
Thousands of men had been DNA tested in the Claremont serial killings case, with more than 10,000 interviewed and more than 100,000 pieces of evidence collected. Mark had lived in Perth between 1993 and 1999, and now investigators wanted to see if they could link him to the unsolved serial killings. Mark would subsequently be ruled out as a suspect in the Claremont serial killings. In early October, Mark made his second court appearance via video link from Belmarsh Prison in North London, where it was ordered that he stand trial for Sally Ann's murder. Meanwhile, it was announced that the council had removed Sally Ann's memorial plaque and denied a permanent plaque. As the prosecution and defence were preparing for trial, Linda handed out personal alarms as part of a safety campaign. The pocket-sized alarm, which doubled as a torch, was handed out to women in Croydon, along with a leaflet providing practical advice about personal safety. Linda and the rest of Sally Ann's family had hoped that the alarms could at least prevent some women meeting the same fate as Sally Ann. In December, Mark was back in court where he pleaded not guilty to the murder of Sally Ann. Just months later, it was announced that Mark's trial was pushed back until July of 2007. Shortly thereafter, it was pushed back once again until the following year. The reason it was pushed back was to give investigators enough time to gather further evidence from abroad. Finally, in February of 2008, the murder trial of Mark Dixie rolled around.
When we first went into the courtroom at the Old Bailey, the murderer was already in the box. And we were less than 3 foot away from him. And I could feel him staring round, looking round.
During opening statements, prosecutor Brian Altman warned the jury that graphic photographs of Sally Ann's body were going to be shown. He described how Mark had put forward a desperate defence and would confess during trial that he had sex with Sally Ann as she lay in a pool of her own blood, but would claim that he wasn't the one who had killed her. he would assert that he had stumbled across the crime scene and had sex with Sally Ann's body. Prosecutor Altman said that Sally Ann had been raped before and after death, and Mark's bite mark matched a bite mark to her neck and cheek. Additionally, Mark's bloody fingerprint was discovered on Sally Ann's shoe. Her murder was motivated by sex. Her killer murdered her for his sexual gratification, and the killer was Mark Dixie. Mark Dixie admits he had sex with her after her death, but denies that he is the killer, announced Prosecutor Altman. Prosecutor Altman went on to describe Mark as a violent sex offender with a history of crimes. At the age of 17, Mark indecently assaulted and punched a female Jehovah's Witness in London on the 21st of June, 1988. Around 10 years later, a 20-year-old student was stabbed 8 times by a sex offender in a suburb of Perth, Australia. The woman was raped but survived the attack. The DNA at the crime scene was a match to Mark. He said that Mark's defence would be a smokescreen and that the earlier attacks proved that Mark had a propensity to violent sex attacks. Mark Dixie killed Sally Ann with a knife with which he had deliberately armed himself. The idea that in one and the same place there was not only a homicidal maniac who motivelessly stabbed a young beautiful woman to death, but also a sex offender, is a ludicrous claim born of desperation, said the prosecution. On the night of Sally Ann's murder, Mark had spent the night celebrating his 35th birthday with friends, drinking and snorting cocaine. He returned to his friend's flat on Avondale Road, just 2 streets away from Sally Ann's home. Lewis was one of the first witnesses to take the stand. He told the court how their final moments together were consumed by a petty, jealous row. It went into an argument. I thought she had been with boys that night, and she thought I had been with girls. It was just jealousy. There may have been raised voices, but not shouting. Nobody outside the car would have heard it. We then made up, hugging and kissing. But Sally Ann didn't want me to leave, and we started to argue, said Lewis. Sally Ann eventually got out of the car, and Lewis looked in his rearview mirror and saw Sally Ann as she was just about to enter the drive leading to her front door. It was here that Sally Ann was attacked and murdered. She didn't even make it to the front door. Mark's defense lawyer cross-examined Lewis and suggested that he was the killer. Are you being serious? Questioned Lewis. Anne Hardy, the neighbor who found Sally Ann's body, also testified during trial. She described how she sank to her knees in horror when she came across Sally Ann's body. According to Anne, she had heard screams the night before, but didn't think anything of it. When she woke in the morning, she looked out of the window and saw a pair of legs sticking out behind the skip. She pulled on her dressing gown and went down to investigate. It was Sally Ann's body. I didn't know her, but I knelt down. It was just the natural thing to do, she explained. Another neighbour, June Cumpter, also described hearing a scream in the early morning hours. She told the court that she looked out the window and saw a dark-haired man in the street. Dr. Peter Jarrett, the pathologist who conducted Sally Ann's autopsy, was called to the witness stand. He described how Sally Ann was most likely first stabbed in the neck from behind. There were defensive wounds to her arms and hands, which were caused as Sally Ann attempted to defend herself against the attack. She was stabbed a total of 7 times, including 2 major wounds that passed through her stomach and exited out the back. She had been sexually assaulted, and concrete was found in her mouth and her vagina, and she had been bitten 4 times, 1 on her left cheek, 2 on her neck, and 1 on her breast. One of Mark's friends, Victoria Chandler, testified that on the night of Sally Ann's murder, Mark had drank pints of beer, shots of Sambuca, 2 bottles of wine, and had taken cocaine. Later that night, he had returned to Victoria's house and slept on her sofa before sneaking out. 2 weeks later, another friend asked Mark if he was going to respond to the police appeal for DNA testing. Mark became irate at the friend and shouted, "Why would I? I was in the flat all night. Are you calling me a fucking murderer?" Within days, Mark moved to Amsterdam. The unnamed Jehovah's Witness, who Mark had attacked in the past, also testified during trial from behind a screen. She had known Mark's girlfriend at the time. And one afternoon, Mark invited her inside, saying that his girlfriend was inside. Mark then grabbed the woman and said, "You have to help me. You have to help me. I need it." Mark then punched the woman in the eye and upper jaw before placing his hands around her throat. Somehow, the woman persuaded Mark to get into her car and go back to her flat in Plumstead. Instead, the woman drove to her parents' house and told Mark to wait at the gates. When he realised that somebody else was in the house, he fled. Mark was later arrested and admitted indecent assault and causing actual bodily harm. The 20-year-old unidentified woman, who was stabbed by Mark in Perth in 1998, also testified against him. She told the court that she was getting ready for bed at a friend's house on the 21st of June 1998 when a man wearing a stocking over his head climbed through the window armed with a knife. He ordered her to take off her clothes and she screamed and kicked him. He then launched a vicious attack on the woman, stabbing her 8 times, causing her to pass out. When she awoke, her underwear was pulled down and she knew that she had been raped. She spent 5 days in the hospital with a collapsed lung and DNA testing showed that the attacker had been Mark. Following testimony from the two women, Mark's defence lawyer, Anthony Glass, told the courtroom that Mark did not kill Sally Ann but had sex with her corpse after somebody else had killed her. He did not kill Sally Ann. His semen in or on her body was on account of him having sex with her after she was killed by her murderer. You might think it is a very unattractive defence. He did not know she was dead until intercourse was over, said defence Glass. Mark was next to testify on his own behalf. He claimed that he was on cocaine when he stumbled across Sally Ann's dead body on the street. "I took full advantage. I know I should not have done it," he said. He claimed he did not realise that she was dead until later. "I would not expect to see anybody dead in that street. I thought she had passed out drunk or fallen over. I didn't expect anybody to be lying dead in a quiet cul-de-sac like that," said Mark. He alleged that when he was finished, he realised that she was dead and decided he needed to try and cover up his DNA. He claimed he grabbed concrete and attempted to use it to wipe any traces of himself. During trial, it was revealed that a search of Mark's belongings uncovered a video of him masturbating to a photograph of Sally Ann, which was on the front page of the Daily Mail. Additionally, investigators were able to find the photograph in question, and it had a sticky substance on it. DNA testing showed that the substance was Mark's semen. When questioned, Mark claimed, "I came over the paper. It wasn't meant to be detrimental to Miss Bowman at all." Prosecutor Altman countered his claim and said that he had been reliving the killing. In closing arguments, Prosecutor Altman pointed out the glaring similarities between Sally Ann's murder and the attack on the woman in Perth 10 years ago. He said that believing Mark's version of events would make Mark the unluckiest man alive. "He has put up a smokescreen before you in the hope that you will be gullible and fall for his story. But it is not just incredible, but pure fantasy," said Prosecutor Altman. Closing the defence's case, Anthony Glass asked the jury if they could be sure that it wasn't Lewis who had killed Sally Ann. After just 3.5 hours of deliberation, the jury found Mark Dixie guilty of murder. The verdict was met with cheers from Sally Ann's loved ones. Mark was sentenced to life in prison, with the judge recommendation that he serve at least 34 years. Outside of court, Sally Ann's father, Paul, said, "The last 2 years have been torturously painful and difficult. Sally Ann, you may have been taken from us, but rest assured, you will be forever missed and never forgotten." Following his conviction, investigators said that they would continue investigating Mark in relation to the other sex crimes. It would later be revealed that Mark started his trail of sex crimes at the age of 16 when he lived in Stockwell. In May of 1986, Mark, using the alias of Mark MacDonald, held a knife to a girl's throat and sexually assaulted her. He was charged with indecent assault, but the charge was later withdrawn in court. As he moved from Sidcup to Plumstead, and then on to Croydon. He changed his name over and over again, but his obsession with violence and sex never waned. In 1988, he exposed himself to a woman and forced her to the ground, and just a few months later, he attacked a Jehovah's Witness before raping the woman in Perth. In New Year's Day of 1999, Mark attacked a woman on the coastal road just outside Perth. Passing her in his car, he pulled over, hid in a bush and removed his clothing. When she passed his hiding place, he jumped out. The woman managed to survive and alerted police, who deported him back to Britain, but did so without informing British police of his crime. It also emerged that Mark had been involved in a string of violent sexual and other assaults in Australia between 1993 and 1999. Australian police only told British police about his background 9 months after he was deported, and only after they were asked. The cooperation of Victoria Police was described by DCI Cundy as poor. Mark's DNA would additionally be matched to the rape of a woman in Fuengirola, Spain, where he had lived in 2003. However, Romano van der Dussen had been charged with the crime and sentenced to 15 years in prison. When investigators discovered that it was a match to Mark, Spanish police refused to reopen the case because somebody had already been convicted. In 2015, Mark finally confessed to the rape in Fuengirola, and van der Dussen was finally released from prison. He had spent 12 years in prison for a rape he did not commit. He had missed his daughter growing up and had missed his mother's funeral. Shortly thereafter, Mark's DNA would tie him to a rape in Croydon in 1987. In total, Mark had 17 other criminal convictions.
He is a monster of an individual that has clearly led a double life. He's been able to submerge himself in normal society, pass himself off between friends and family as a normal individual. And I believe whilst he's been outside normal relationships, has committed horrific offences, committed attempted murders, sexual assaults, rapes of young females.
DNA in this case was crucial to catching the killer, and it prompted new calls for samples from every single resident of Britain to be stored on file. The calls sparked a fierce debate about civil liberties and security, and ultimately, the call for such a register was turned down by ministers and other politicians.
I think about Sally every 5 seconds of the day, 7 days a week. And the house, and I look at the bedroom, and you know, I see her clothes. I've got some of her clothes hanging up my wardrobe, her pillows laying on my bed that I sleep with every night. You get that split second in the morning when you wake up and your life is perfect. Everything's how you want it to be. And then, bang, it's there and it hits you. Worrying to close your eyes, not knowing what you're going to see, not knowing if you're going to see that Sally that you remember or that Sally you see from the pictures. And that fear goes through me every night when I go to sleep. The nightmares don't ever stop. Just the ones where you just wanting to get to her and there's nothing you can do.
There's constant reminders. And there's days where I sit and think of her and I have a huge smile on my face and I think of some of the funny things and practical jokes she's played. And then there's days I just want to shut myself away from the whole world and pretend it's not happened and she's just having a long holiday. I think to myself, if she could talk to us, to me, her dad and her sister, she'd probably just say, "Mum, I want my life back. Mum, I want to come home." But it's never going to happen, is it?
The animal hasn't just taken Sally, but he's taken a piece of all of us. And he's taken a bigger piece from my mum, who were never meant, never meant.
Sally Ann Bowman had big dreams and big promise, but her life was snuffed out by a repeat offender who should not have even been walking the streets. Mark Dixie had a disturbing history of violent sex crimes against women. It is well known that sexually motivated violence tends to escalate, and Mark should have been on the radars of police forces in several countries. Despite his convictions, Mark was continually let go with little more than a slapped wrist. And it was Sally Ann that paid the ultimate price. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my new Patreon supporter, Jana Beth Yardbur. The support on Patreon really does go such a long way in allowing Morbidology to continue as a weekly podcast, and I am eternally grateful. So if you want exclusive episodes of Morbidology, as well as ad-free early release episodes and other goodies, please feel free to check out Morbidology on Patreon or Himalaya Plus. The links are in the show notes. Can I also ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider giving me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Massive thank you to anybody who has already left a review. It truly helps out, and the support is very much appreciated. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Stolen Lives. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
We often hear of parents warning their children about the dangers of strangers. But the reality is, children are more likely to come to harm by people they know than people they don't. Here at Stolen Lives, children cases are important to us. That's why we do what we do. We hope to bring awareness to the lost or to the forgotten. Cases like the brutal murder of Kelsey Shelton Smith, searching for answers to discover the identity of Delta Dawn, and the unsolved missing persons case of Tabitha Tutors. Listen to Stolen Lives on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to great podcasts like the one you're listening to today.